In some ways, this passage is very familiar, but it's very deep. There's a lot between lines, as it were, that we don't necessarily see if we just read it through. And hopefully I've managed to reach into it a bit, especially the first two-thirds of it. And hopefully we shall see a little deeper into it tonight. I know I have in studying it. We are familiar with the essence of it. We know that Jesus did ask this question, "Who do you say I am?" And we know the answer, but it's very easy to just go over that quickly and not really see into what he was really getting at and what they were really saying. So it's very familiar, but it's deeper than we often see in it. It's quite hard to imagine that the disciples were, as it were, having a quiet day with Jesus. They were out on the hill somewhere, it would appear. They've been quite busy. There's been the feeding of the 5,000. He sent out the 12 and brought, had them back again. There's been all sorts of other things going on as well, calming the storm, the dead girl. Lots going on. And now they're relaxed. The Jewish leaders would have been very puzzled by this answer of Jesus. They were looking at him from the position of centuries of serving off and on to varying degrees one God. They had the scrolls of the Pentateuch and the prophets. They had the expectation of a Messiah who would one day appear and sort out all the mess of the centuries for them. Yes, they looked forward to that. But this Jesus, could it be him? And of course today many, a majority probably in our own society, think that at best he was a great teacher, but no more than that. And for us in the past few Sunday nights, we've walked with his disciples through some of these events that Luke has brought us to, as they began to get to know this man who was obviously a man of God, unusually adept as a teacher and preacher. He could hold the attention of individuals and groups and huge crowds. He commanded demons, illness and storms, among other things. And as the Jewish leaders tried to outmaneuver him and catch him out in blasphemy or some other error, they could get nowhere with him, really. They tried, but they were getting nowhere. And he is, as well as that, the disciples' friend. And that's why he's invited them to spend time with him on this occasion, to picnic possibly with him. That made them smile as they thought of the last picnic that they'd had just before, with 5,000. Maybe they were laughing about it. How they'd got more food for the few of them than they'd had for all that many, and yet they were still fed. They were probably still thinking about it, and how he'd done it. How did it happen? You get the feeling in verse 18 that it was a sleepy sort of day. Jesus had gone off praying, probably not that far away. They might well have been able to see him. And the disciples were probably resting. And he comes back to them, and here comes the first question: who do the crowds say I am? Who do the crowds say I am? I'm sure the crowds had been discussing it, and no doubt the disciples had as well. Whenever those sort of questions came up, about who somebody was, John the Baptist was a key feature at the time. He'd been around a lot. He was very much in people's minds down at the Jordan where he'd been baptising, and he'd also been up in the north where Jesus and his disciples still were. We know that because he'd had a run-in with Herod, if you remember. Herod had decided to marry his sister-in-law. And John told him what he thought of that, in no uncertain terms, which ended up with John in prison. So the people up here in the north in Galilee would be very familiar with John at this point. And he was certainly, he was another very different person. His baptizing and his preaching were of a class all of their own. So it was quite not surprising that he got mentioned as they thought about the answer and possibly all said different bits of this verse 19. Somebody probably said, oh, well, John the Baptist. People think you're something to do with John the Baptist, definitely. And then, of course, he'd been not only imprisoned by Herod, but also executed. And even Herod thought he might return. He wasn't totally sure that John wasn't going to come back and, as we might say, haunt him again. So John the Baptist was, yes, a contender. Others say Elijah. Elijah was one of two men in the Old Testament who didn't die. What was the first one? Enoch. Enoch. I was getting mixed up with Methuselah. Enoch was the one that didn't die. Yeah. The other one was Elijah. If you remember, he had quite a dramatic departure. He was told that he wouldn't die, and chariots of fire and horses came and swept him up from before Elisha, who was watching this. And Elijah's robe fell, and Elisha picked it up and continued the ministry. So because Elijah hadn't died, he was an obvious contender for coming back, it would seem. And after that occasion, or sometime after that occasion, it became the tradition that Passover meals would always include an empty chair, just in case Elijah reappeared at this point. Which is a fascinating history, isn't it, really? So Elijah was definitely a contender for having returned, in many people's eyes, probably. And various other prophets were mentioned too. The idea that prophets came back in sometimes was quite current. And the discussion was drifting on in verse 19, when Jesus said, possibly almost interrupting a gentle chat, but what about you? Who do you say I am? I would love to know how long the gap was between the first half of verse 20 and the second half of it. Knowing Peter, he may have come out with the answer straight away. But we don't know that. There may have been quite a silence while they thought, hang on, what's he after? What's going on? Who is he? But it was Peter who answered, as we know. And he answered, God's Messiah. God's Messiah. That's how it puts it in that latest NIV. In mine, which is the earlier edition of the NIV, it says the Christ of God. Which I must admit, I think I prefer. It means the same thing. It's translated from the same Greek. God's Messiah, or the Christ of God. The word Christ has Messiah built into it. So it is the same, really. I think because I prepared it from this and only really late on discovered that it was slightly different in the newer one. That may be why I like it. But it's the same. It's the same thing. The Christ, the Messiah, from God. I bet that had got them all woken up. If they'd been a bit sleepy, they probably had literally sat up and were listening. He's the Messiah. We don't know whether Peter realised at that moment or whether he or any of them had been coming to that conclusion. The sort of Messiah that was generally expected was a much more sort of upbeat and possibly political character. But yes, they had answered the Christ of God, God's Messiah. And immediately Jesus warns them not to tell anyone. If they weren't to tell anyone, why has he told them? question that hangs there. Anyway, he went on and said to them, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. That was certainly not what they were expecting. They wouldn't have been expecting that at all. I wonder why they thought he'd said it. Could there have been a risk of riots, or could the crowds have turned against him? Or the Jewish leaders have acted more quickly than they would needed to? Would he be recognised as the Messiah, given the sort of life he had been living before them? It wasn't what they expected of a Messiah. For us, there isn't the shock, if you like, of Peter's answer, because we've all, most of us, I think, probably grown up knowing that he is the Christ, the Messiah. And it's quite difficult to work out how one would feel if one heard it for the first time as an adult. Can you remember when you came to that conclusion that Jesus was God's Messiah, Son of God? But like the 12, we all come on different journeys. The question is the key to this whole passage. Who do you say I am? Vital question. If Jesus was not the Christ of God, not God incarnate, not fully God and fully human, the whole thing would be in vain. And who Jesus is today is as vital as it was then. No prophet, and there had been plenty in the Old Testament, no prophet could do more than teach, entreat, explain, and pray. Jesus is the only one who has bridged the gap between humanity and the eternal God. Humanity being tied up in sin, God the holy, perfect creator and sustainer of the world, the only source of eternal life. Literally poles apart. God and his people were poles apart because of sin. And Jesus is bridging the gap. The Christ of God. Today many in our society dismiss Jesus completely, or as just a good man. Although I think many, if not most, do accept he existed. Some would agree more with the view attributed to the crowd of other people, other teachers, similar to previous teachers, an exceptional individual, a historic figure, a great teacher, but no more than that. And those suggestions are not enough, are they? He is still the only way to God. He is still the way, the truth, and the life, as he said in John 14. He is the only one to bridge the gap. It reminded me the well-known old illustration, some of you will remember, I'm sure, of the bridge. I think it goes back to Billy Graham in the 50s and 60s. I think it was one the navigators brought over for the follow-up on those occasions. The idea being that the cross spans the gap between man, sinful on this side, God on this side. The cross in the middle forms the bridge for people to walk across. Because Jesus has, if you like, irreverently a foot in each camp. But the phrase serves quite well. It was a good illustration. It still works well today, although many others have taken over from it, I think, since. Back to Peter's words. The Christ of God. They contain the truth of God incarnate. God sitting there with them on the hillside. Human as well. We can't understand it, really. It's one we have to accept. No ordinary human being could save himself before God, let alone anybody else. And the disciples have had their first glimpse of the truth, of Jesus' real reality. He brings them right down to earth, breaking the spell as it was, with his next words, verse 21. He strictly warned them not to tell anyone, not to tell this to anyone, no one at all. He'd taken them right away from everybody in order to tell them this. Don't say anything to anyone. Oh, it sounded exciting. They were probably just beginning to think, yeah. And he says, don't tell anyone. Their journey of discipleship, if you like, had moved up to a new level, a new seriousness, a new, completely new level. They needed time to get their heads adjusted to it, really. Because they actually wouldn't really take it on board or realise the implications till at least Easter, if not Pentecost. So he warned them not to tell anyone. They'd have got themselves tied up in knots, no doubt, and there would have been all sorts of repercussions if that had gone round at the wrong time. And then he went on. He went on. Verse 22 was no doubt even more of a shock for them. The Son of Man. He calls himself now the Son of Man. The Christ of God, the Son of Man. His personality of the two. His identity of the two is there. The Son of Man must suffer many things. They wouldn't have been expecting that. They'd seen him jostled by a few crowds. They'd seen the Jews quite seriously displeased with him. But they would not have been expecting that. Must suffer many things. And be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, the teachers of the law. That wouldn't have been a huge surprise because there'd already been several clashes. And he must be killed. He must be killed. And on the third day be raised to life. I'm not sure which bit of that would have struck them hardest. Might have been different for different ones. They're all, if you note, they're all passive things, really. The Son of Man must suffer. That is from things that will be done to him. In that last week especially. He must suffer many things. He was going to be rejected by the elders. That had already started, hadn't it, really? The chief priests, the teachers of the law. They became increasingly antagonistic as time went by. Suffering and the rejection were ongoing. Then he comes to two that were one-off events. He must be killed. That must have gone into them like a knife. He must be killed. But he went on. And on the third day, be raised to life. Wow. It was a lot for them to take in. He must suffer at the hands of others. Antagonism, misunderstanding, ignorance. He will be rejected. People will turn away from him. The religious leaders will refuse to take him on board, take him seriously. He must be killed. And finally, he will be raised to life on the third day by his Father. He has come humbly to do the will of his Father, to fulfil his plan. And this that he has just explained to them was the climax of his whole life. They had no idea of it at this point up till now. They probably thought he would continue to teach for far longer. They probably hadn't thought a vast amount about it, actually. It was a a dramatic day. Saw them. Then we have a new paragraph starting at verse 23. He changes the emphasis slightly. In Matthew and Mark, which both have all of this material very, very similar, they're actually spread, the sections are actually spread out a bit. If you look at verse 23, certainly in my older NIV, I think it's the same in yours if I remember rightly, it says, then he said to them all, and starts explaining, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself. Familiar passage. That's in Mark. Is it Mark? I think it's Mark. You can't see where I wrote it now. It's one of them anyway. I think it's Mark. It's slightly separated from the previous bit. And it actually says that he called the crowds to him at that point. So it's at least possible that 23 onwards was actually addressed to a larger crowd. Nick may be able to find out the answer to that one from one of his books, I expect, somewhere. But it would make sense in a way if it is addressed to a larger group. But let's look at it. If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily and follow me. Take up his cross. That phrase sounds as if the cross has actually been mentioned. It hasn't, as far as I can see. He said he's going to be killed. You wonder whether something along those lines was a phrase for suffering. You could carry a cross daily. You obviously couldn't be crucified daily. I think it must imply just suffering and a heavy load, possibly, with maybe the idea of moving towards one's death. If you want to come after me, if you want to follow me, you're going to have to be second. Following me has got to be first. Big ask. They had known him a while now. I don't know quite how long, but I would imagine months to a year, possibly. Maybe a bit longer. But the relationship was quite new and a lot had happened. If anyone would come after me, wants to come after me, decides to come after me, you are going to have to deny yourself, step back, and take up with me. Take up with what I'm doing. Take up with where I'm going. Follow me. Physically and spiritually. It goes on into verse 24. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me will save it. That's a good paradox, isn't it? Two other things. Compare them. The key words in there are for me. For me. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life will save it is nothing without those two words. Whoever loses his life for me, for my sake, it could say, will save it. It's a choice that they had to look at. Those words probably came back to them. Memorable sort of phrases. It would have come back to them, I think. And it is there for us as well. What are we after in life? Are we looking for the good of our life? Or are we letting loose of that? Letting go of that? For him. It's a challenging question. Verse 25 says a very similar thing, really. along the lines of, we could probably translate it as, what's the point of winning the jackpot but dying in the attempt? Or something like that. What good is it for someone, a man or a woman, to gain the whole world, the jackpot, and yet lose or forfeit himself, his values or his life or his future or any of the things that we tend to like to hang on to? And verse 26. Two of these started with if. Verse 23 is the first one. He said, if anyone will come after me, deny himself. And again in 26, if. If anyone is ashamed of me and my words, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his glory and in the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. I wonder if that came into Peter's mind when he denied knowing Jesus. I wonder if he remembered that then. Such words tend to come back when we don't want them, don't they? They come back into our minds and whack us in the face when we've got caught up with something. But in John 20:21, somewhere around there, we see Jesus bringing Peter back, forgiving him, talking to him, giving him peace back from the anguish he must have felt when he realised what he'd done. That he had been, in a sense, ashamed of Jesus, that he'd denied him. So that passage from 23 may have been to the 12, it may have been to a bigger group. It definitely has a lot to say to us. I think it's one that's worth reading through more than once. In fact, if you're coming on Wednesday, for Ash Wednesday, is it 7:30 in church? Is it sort of a mix of prayer time and service, is it, do I gather?
Mainly communion service.
Mainly, yeah. Reflection and corporate prayer, right. Might be worth wearing a coat because it might be chilly in church midweek. Depends on the weather as well. Do come on Wednesday because Nick is going to be looking at this passage again. Being as it's Ash Wednesday, it's an appropriate passage. So there will be possibly some more thoughts on this passage then. So if we can meditate on it and think about it in the meantime, that might be good. It's an amazing passage. I found it very challenging to spend this week looking at it. They are unique words. The disciples were incredibly privileged to be able to sit there and talk with Jesus, let him talk to them like this. These words that he said must have stayed with them. They must have been really, I guess burnt into them isn't quite the right idea, but you know what I mean. It's a passage that can equally, although we aren't sat there on a hill in Galilee, have meaning for us. And it's one to keep coming back to. And I pray that this Easter it might increase in its meaning and we might be guided how to respond to it. Amen.